Karen Black, Easy Rider, Five Easy Pieces, The King of the Drive, he said, Invaders from Mars.
And you know what, one of my favorite Karen Black things? It's very obscure, but I love her in Reuben and Ed with Crispin Glover and Howard Hessman. And she plays Howard Hessman's sort of witchy wife that bedevils him throughout the entire movie, and she's got a couple of really funny scenes in that. But she's so great. She's been all over the place. I just recently watched a great movie with her that's very hard to find. I got it on VHS. I'm going and buying a whole bunch of VHSs these days because there's a lot of stuff that's out of print that's you know, you can still find on VHS. And I found Rafferty and the Gold Dust Twins with her and Mackenzie Phillips getting together on a road movie with Alan Arkin. And this is
wow. Where Mackenzie Phillips and Howard Hessman. What the heck?
Do I need to take LSD before this? I mean, no, it's just a good little, it's a great little road movie, and it's got an incredible, like, supporting cast. It's got Alex Rocco, who you might remember as Mo Green and The Godfather.
Always Mo Green, yeah.
Yeah, he'll be Mo Green forever. And then it's also got Harry Dean Stanton in it. And it's just a few other interesting character actors in there. It's just a little road movie.
She's also in Some Guy Who Kills People, which is from this year that we brought on the people, and I love that movie. I thought that was movie was a lot of fun. And Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean.
And Trilogy of Terror. Don't forget Trilogy of Terror, the TV movie that she did where she's chased around by little voodoo dolls.
That movie scared the hell out of me as a kid.
It's a big cult offering. So.
And they made a sequel to that. Remember they made a sequel?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't very good.
The sex had a terror.
Let's don't forget, she was also in Nashville. She wrote some songs she performed in Nashville, too. So she's had a very rich career.
So with that build-up, here she is.
Do you remember what drew you to acting and performing?
I have to say, Aaron, I think that people are kind of born like that. I don't think that suddenly someone who would have worked in the bank most of their life decides at the age of 6 that they want to be an actor. You find kids are singing, you know, as their mothers are grocery shopping with them, and they're interested in being in the plays. And in grammar school, you know, they said, we need someone to play Christopher Columbus, and I'd raise my hand. They'd say, you're a girl. That's okay. I can do it. You know, I just always wanted to act, and I just wanted to take acting lessons. I don't remember any shift like anything else, and I just think that's common. And then I had an acting teacher, you know, and I would do community plays as a child, and very comfortable on stage. I'd cry on cue and never thought that there was anything that was difficult about it. And then when I got to be 14, 15, I would do summer stock. I would, you know, pick up all the half-eaten hot dog rolls and the old pop glasses and throw them away and clean the toilets. And then they'd give me one roll in the summer stock theater shows of the summer. So that's, I just don't remember wanting anything else. In fact, when I was in college, since I was so excellent at writing and at literature and English, I had teachers say, you should be a writer. And I have written. I've written about 5 movies that were made into movies. And I wrote a movie that went to Sundance, and I love writing very dearly. But nothing could keep me from going to New York to try to get on Broadway.
And you got on Broadway, I believe it was in the late 50s?
Late 50s, I was still at home in Illinois, watching television. 1965 was my first Broadway play.
Okay.
And I played a 15-year-old girl. Yeah, New York. I did a Broadway show called The Playroom. And I played I guess you'd have to call her a mixed-up 15-year-old. And I was nominated for a Drama Circle Critics Award as Best Actress.
Right.
So that's wonderful.
So in 66, you're in your Coppola's master thesis film. You're a big boy now.
I was in the play. The Playroom on Broadway. And a producer saw me, and he saw Peter Kastner as the leads in the play. And he invited us to meet this young student who was doing a movie as his thesis, and that was Francis Ford Coppola. So we met him, and he was lovely, a lovely guy. And we were in his first movie.
What do you remember of that experience? Because it came out in 1966, and so it predates Mike Nichols' The Graduate about 8 months or so. But both films kind of cover similar themes in a way. But in Geraldine Page was Oscar nominated for it, and in has Rip Torn and said Peter Kastner and so forth. So and it's a wonderful film. I saw it as a kid. My dad showed it to me, and I remember being very taken aback by it. And so I'm curious, at that time, what was it like on that set? And, you know, this was years and years before Coppola would do The Godfather and so forth.
When I met Francis Ford Coppola, I was shy, I didn't want to meet him, and we were in a hotel. I think I jumped into one of those baskets that has towels or things. Peter sort of rolled me to the door, Peter Kastner, and he was my boyfriend at the time. And Francis was very lovely, kind of, and intense in a very soft way. And he would move his hands around and play with his tie and so forth, and he didn't seem to know what his hands were doing. He's very loose-limbed. And I liked him a lot. And, you know, there was some time between the meeting of him and doing the movie. I think we did the movie sort of in the summer, and I met him in the winter. I would say December, November, something like that. That's my memory. Could be a little off. And in the meantime, you know, he took me out to dinner, and we were both quite nearsighted. And so we took up our glasses, and we pressed our heads together, and we looked at the chandelier on the wall. Because, you know, when you're nearsighted, you can see all the colors of the rainbow in any prism. So we pushed our heads together and sort of looked at the chandelier and described colors. And I think that I might have been his girl, but he could see I was madly in love with Peter Kastner. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, he wore a T-shirt that said, "Don't overplay," because he thought people, you know, on Broadway would be prone to overplay on screen. I think he learned finally by the end of his shoot that, you know, it just doesn't work. You do things as big as you want to on screen. And you just, you know, if you really, truly, sincerely mean every word you're saying from the bottom of your gut, it's going to be fine. I don't care how loud you are. It's still going to be real. And certainly, Gerald, nobody was making small for him at all. Certainly, Geraldine Page, she would kind of make funny little tooting noises before the camera would roll to get herself in the mood. I learned that from her. When I made Invaders from Mars, I would scream before the camera would roll so that I could get frightened. Anyhow, she was so fun and so fabulous and so brilliant. And one of her lines is, "Is she pretty? Is she pretty?" And she had this notion that she would just keep cutting her hair. You know, her hair would keep getting shorter and shorter. She just was amazing, amazing.
What was the machinations from your Big Boy Now to you getting into Easy Rider? And what was that production like?
I did this television show and that television show and this play. I did some plays. Just like your ordinary actor thing. The thing that was interesting maybe is that I, you know, at that age was supporting myself and trying to find ways to get on sets and buses. I couldn't drive. I didn't know, have a car. And I'd never driven in my lifetime. And I had my agent driving me around. And I would do these television movies. And I knew Henry Jaglom. I'd known him in New York, and it was because of Henry that I came to L.A. Because he had an agent, Kevin Castleman, see me in the Broadway show and sign me at this very famous restaurant, the Something East, Upstairs East, the Something, the Sardis. And then I flew in, and I had an agent, and I would go up for these television things. This is a very pretty person, you know, young little thing who just come from the Broadway stage. So I got some television shows, and then, you know, we'd go out to eat, and I'd meet Jack Nicholson, and we started knowing each other a little bit. And then I just got a call. Please come and audition for this movie. So Peter and Dennis and I went to kind of a patio. I don't remember quite where we were. Kind of an outdoor patio kind of thing, kind of Mexican looking.
Mm-hmm.
And we improvised, and I thought that Dennis was extremely brilliant. I couldn't believe how good he was. And I said, oh, he said, you're my goddess. You have to be in this movie. I said, okay. Kevin Castleman was out of town, so I typed up my own contract. Gave myself $300, which is what they told me I could have in this movie. Thought that was pretty good. And set out to go down to Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony Basil, who is one of my best friends all these years, still is.
Oh, wow.
One of my very best friends, played the other whore. And, well, you know, she's a choreographer. So she
used to choreographer, musician.
Scheduling, you know, schedules and having people do this and that and keeping rhythm, and it's very organized. And I was used to Broadway. I mean, I had not only done that Broadway show, I've been working in off Broadway shows for 3 years at that point. So we were shocked. I mean, we just couldn't believe the disorder. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Dennis would make up things as he went along, and maybe we wouldn't do anything. We'd sort of lock us in antique stores in the night, and we just got the giggles. Tony and I used to have this terrible case of the giggles all the time. We just wanted to go home. We were so unhappy. But I did observe that Dennis was extraordinarily intense. He had very great intention. I have said this before, he had enough intention to walk right through a wall. He was going to get that part of life down. He was going to shoot that aspect of the culture of that time. He was going to do it. Nothing was going to stop him in this world. And he knew he was improvising. He knew he was making it up as he went along. But that's what he did. And he, with his magnificent spirit, imagination, intention, he started a whole new era of filmmaking, because you know, people were really doing what they were doing when they were doing it in that movie. They weren't acting. They weren't, you know, they were really doing it. And so it ended up being a great movie.
I'm curious, when you finally saw it put together and you saw what was being shown in the theaters, were you also shocked and startled that something was able to come out of all that chaos and that it became such a phenomenon?
Well, I know it makes a good story for me to suddenly see it, and I can understand your curiosity, but it didn't work that way. You know, as time went on, Henry Javelin was involved. He's a friend. He's still a friend of mine, good friend. Working on the sound and putting some of the mutterings that my character did in
mm-hmm.
the graveyard sequence. My character's mutterings were all gone. He put them back, which I thought was a great contribution. And then they were, you know, BBS. And I was already working for BBS. I did, I believe, I'm not sure about the timing of it, but I worked for Jack Nicholson when he directed
Drive, he said.
Yeah, so I was already sort of involved in all that. And so, no, it wasn't that shocked. It wasn't like I went home to Park Ridge, Illinois, and then went back. I was in L.A., Hollywood area. But I saw it with my brother. Which is very dear to me that I saw with my brother. And, of course, it's a very, very great movie, and I was very moved by it. And I was worried about my brother because he's a little too moved by it. Because, you know, in the end, I think, you know, when the camera moves suddenly up, 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 I suspect, from any of my, you know, Eastern religion training, I suspect that that can be what happens when somebody dies. You suddenly go up. You know, but you're looking down, and I think that it brings the audience into that sensibility, into that moment, and they kind of. I think it's one reason it's so shocking. I think without that ending, I'm not sure it would have been the hit it was. It was perfect, and cinematographer nearly fell out of the plane getting it. By the way.
Well, and so you said you were working at BBS, and so I'm curious, what was the intent and what was the atmosphere like for people who were in the BBS circle? And for our listeners, I guess I should clarify that VBS stood for the three people who were part of this production company, Bob Rafelson, Burke Snyder, and Steve Blommer. And this was supposed to be the intent was this was a artist-friendly, filmmaker-friendly production company where everyone was going to support each other's kind of film projects.
It was indeed, you can believe the hype. It was indeed artist-friendly, filmmaker-friendly. When we did Five Easy Pieces, we were on our own. I mean, Five Easy Pieces was shot absolutely in sequence. You know, we shot what we had to shoot in town, I mean, in Bakersfield, and then we went up from there. And we shot the story as we drove, just the way the story was written. So when we picked up the tools, we picked them up. And when we went to the next place to eat breakfast, that's when we went to eat breakfast. It was really had a reality like that. And I don't remember anybody calling anybody and saying anything to anybody about anything. It was very artist-friendly and very free. I think that Jen Nicholson, when he did, I think, Steve Blauner's film, A Drive, he said, or it was VBS films, all of them. I think he didn't have enough organization. I think he could be a very great director, and I'm disappointed that I think some of these experiences sort of turned him off becoming one. He said to me, you know, I know a great script when I see one. I might as well be a director. Because when we were doing, I think it was Five Easy Pieces, you walk into Jack's motel room where we were traveling, you know, there were like, must have been 100 scripts there. And he'd have to like sort through or read through or get one or two pages and pick, you know, and he always could. So, but when we did Drive, he said he had just too many things to do. But aside from that, which I thought was just poor planning, you know, for example, when we were doing Easy Rider, it was, you know, we were off in the middle of the woods. We were there together. I don't remember people worrying about money particularly because what was there to spend money on, you know, to film, that's all it was. I mean, but don't ask me about money. I'm not any good at it. I don't understand it. But, you know, it was incredibly. I mean, you know, when you do a studio film and people are watching you, watching what you're shooting and if you've gone over time and if you've gone over the budget and if you've gone over schedule and if you came in on time and if, you know, they like the rushes and they don't want to do this, they want to change that and that. None of that. Absolutely none of that. Where you're off on your own. Now, that is good things and bad things, but essentially, obviously, good things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because Rafelson took her script, which was brilliant anyway, and just made it what it was. That was what you got. You got the real story. And Rafelson being very much on his own is how that would work best, and it did.
And Five Easy Pieces.
For Five Easy Pieces.
Yeah, and Five Easy Pieces is an interesting film in that it's the first showcase for Nicholson as a leading man. He's been in movies for over a decade, but he'd always been in co-starring roles or supporting roles like an Easy Rider and so forth. But Five Easy Pieces, it's a character study all about kind of a remarkable turn of the decade, late 60s into the early 70s. Kind of a lost in the wilderness kind of character portraits that Nicholson was a master at doing, it turns out.
Yes. Well, it's. I think that I wouldn't agree with your line of logic.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't that he did all these roles that were smaller roles, and now he did the lead.
Right.
The movies that he made, even including Easy Rider, I have to say, in terms of character and in terms of just, you know, a classic movie that'll always be alive, classic movie, they weren't as good as Five Easy Pieces. Five Easy Pieces is a very brilliant movie. And all these old, you know, I've seen these early darling sort of, he's so darling in them, these Jack Nicholson movies, and they're just not very good movies. And this was a very great movie by a very, very great writer. And a great director, and so one could finally witness his full capability. I think before that one just hadn't had a chance to. You knew you loved him. You know, there's something about people, certain people, that you just love. And I don't think anybody can name it. I don't think anybody can explain it. You know, like Drew Barrymore. What is it about Drew Barrymore? I mean, we love her. we have to have more of her, you know? And Jack was like that. He just has God-blessed smile, and, you know, you just have to have him in your house. You have to buy the movie. You have to go see it. Something about Jack, you know, he's just a big movie star. He just was born to be that.
And that kind of collaboration you all had, I mean, it carried over to the following film, which was Drive, He Said, which Jack directed. He didn't star in it. It was his directorial debut. And Drive, He Said, is kind of remarkable in that it's never been available on tape or DVD of any kind. So this is kind of a landmark event where it's finally coming out. And so for those of us who have been lucky enough to see it, whether it's through a bootleg or a rare showing on TV, it is a remarkable kind of a lost gem of this period between of you and Bruce Dern and the other, and kind of a, the story of Drive, He Said, is kind of interesting in that it also kind of captures kind of that kind of a turbulent, chaotic period of life on college campus in late 60s, early 70s.
Yes, yes. Did you ever see Getting Straight?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
That was probably the... Gee, what's that word? It means it's sort of the center, the pith, the best, the most representative of that era and that time. Well, I think that there are some very interesting oddities about Drive, He Said. You know, I was in a bathtub. I think it was naked. And I was not into being naked. I mean, not really. I mean, you have to really love your body to feel it. And then I put on a robe and ran outside, and we were running around in the wet cold. And the man who played my husband was also a brilliant writer, is also a brilliant writer. And he was like, whoa, what? He's a conservative guy. He's a writer. You know, what are you doing? And running around in your robe is going to fall open. Everything's falling out. It was just such a lot of crazy stuff. It was such an amazing, you know, difference doing that movie and doing Five Easy Pieces. There's such an incredible difference, just the sense of the place and the sense of the time, the sense of the light and color, and the sense of the character. We used to smoke in those days, Jack would say. Everybody's going to want to smoke when they see you smoking, Blackie. Better quit that.
I'm curious.
And Bill Tepper was in it, Bill Tepper and... Yeah. Well, tell me his name, Mag, the lead, the young boy's lead.
Yeah, Michael Margada.
Yeah, Michael Margada. Now, there was a gem of an actor. I think he's in Russia teaching acting now. I think he's a really the acting guru somewhere in Russia. I'm not kidding. I think this is the truth. Well, it was just a bunch of gorgeous guys. It was just incredible. Great experience. Very strange experience.
I'm curious.
Not strange. I shouldn't say very strange. Very, very what it was. Sort of epicenter Jack.
I am curious. You bring up the bathtub scene and so forth. And Drive, He Said.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What, bring up what?
The bathtub scene, you know, and
oh,
so
bathtub,
forth.
Oh, bathtub, huh?
And Drive, He Said, at that time, if you remember, was given an X rating. This was at the time. For some of its sexual content, which I'm sure viewed now is obviously not as, you know, graphic and gratuitous as we see now, but it is very...
You're going to fail to get any good information if you expect an actor to have an overview. You know, actors don't have an overview. You do a movie, and then they want you to lie around and kiss someone. Then do another movie, they want you to sit in his lap and kiss, and you do.
Right.
And you don't think, oh, this is very interesting historically. All you know
right.
is, you know, you're kissing Bruce Dern, and whether you like to kiss him or not is really what you got your attention on, rather than what's going on in the film community in this particular
right.
decade.
What do you remember? Do you remember anything, I guess, anything that stands out during this BBS production period of your life? Because obviously it didn't last forever, but the legacy of these films, has lasted. So I'm curious if, you know, when you think back at this kind of 5-6 year period of your life, what comes to the surface?
And I remember doing Five Easy Pieces, and there was a scene that wasn't in the movie. that was shot, that we rehearsed in the bedroom with Rapelson, Jack and I in a bed, just because we were sitting there and talking.
Right.
And what I had used was for the character, for the scene, was something that I'd learned some years earlier when Peter Kasser and I were also sitting in another bed in New York City, and he had something to say to me that was a confession. And when he confessed it, he put it one hand over one half of his face. You know, and as an actor, what you do is you go around and you sort of make, you memorize things that you can use later. So I used that. I sat in the bed, and I put one hand over one, because in this particular scene, I confessed that I had gone to bed with somebody at the motel, in the another room in the motel, where he'd stashed me, Jack, when he went to see his family. He just stashed me away there. Which I think was great, because I don't think the character should have done that, and I'm glad she didn't in the movie. But in the actual screenplay, she did. So I put one hand over one side of my face, and luckily the eye that wept was the one that was not covered. And I was just confessing to him and talking, and he so flattered me. He said, "You've got so many moves, Blackie." He so improved my confidence. He's an extremely generous spirit and a great, great spirit. He's a great person. And so Five Easy Pieces and working with Jack really made me a confident actor. It was a very beautiful beginning for me because of the confidence that he installed in me, and probably part of that, the birth of that, is the confidence that BBS had in him.
Well, before I let you go, I got to ask one question of one of my all-time favorite movies, and since I have you on the phone, I got to ask if you could tell me any story or any anecdote of making Nashville.
Well, Nashville was heaven, and Five Easy Pieces was heaven, and each of them had a similar great, serene joy, but it's not exactly joy, because that's kind of bouncy. This is just heaven. Doing each of these movies was the most wonderful experience. Everyone was just beyond. Everyone was unbelievable. All these people were so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
In Nashville, you know, we were really a family of people, and he creates that, I think, with his cast. You know, somehow he's so safe. It's like a big party. Nashville was just a big party, not a place, in the best sense of that sensibility of enjoying one another's company. And I think it's, you know, he has certain predilections, Robert, or had. Of course, I always think people continue after they die and they come back and they make movies again. I kind of think that. Or they make music again or whatever. Anyway, you know, we didn't remember where the camera was. We didn't remember where the... we didn't remember we were being... You know, you just didn't remember that you were actually on film half the time. You just kept improvising.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in character and you kept improvising. And then what happened, you know, happened to your character. So it was an extraordinary experience.
And then you would work with him.
I was standing backstage, you know, when you start talking, I was standing backstage fluffing out my gown, you know, before I walked on stage for the Grand Ole Opry, and really I didn't remember there was a camera watching me. I didn't know that was going to be a movie, you know. And I just happened to say to these little boys, you know, one of them going to be president, because that's how this character would think. Yeah, it was a very great time.
And you were lucky enough to work with him again on Come Back to the Five and Dine, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, which was, also a big film for Cher and her, you know, really, really taking off in acting.
Yes.
Which is unfortunately not available on DVD or tape, but hopefully one day it will be, because that also is a remarkable Robert Altman film, and a totally different Altman film than Nashville.
Yes, it was strictly the play. It's exactly the play. So, of course, it wasn't improvised at all. But think about it, Nashville, to go back to that just for a second. I was going to say that he has these predilections. He likes the messiness of life, you know, chaos and the idiosyncrasies of people and how it's unpredictable and you don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, he loves to have movies sort of imitate that part of life. You know, it's funny, it's off, it's odd.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he gets. You know, when I saw MASH, I thought, oh my God, they're interrupting each other. But of course they're interrupting each other. People do interrupt each other. People always interrupt each other, except maybe you, Karen. and so why should that be on film? And so, of course, he mic'd everybody so that each person had their own channel. So if you got interrupted, you could just print it all. I mean, you could just record it all. It would all be there. You wouldn't lose anything anybody said if somebody else started talking in the middle because they had their own sound channel, everybody. He created that, the new kind of way of looking at making movies. And I just think he's the greatest. I love him. I saw his wife, Catherine, the weekend before last, because Sally Kellerman was singing, doing a show. And we had a lovely getting back together. She's just the most charming woman you've ever seen in your life. She's so gracious. I embrace her. And now, what were you going to talk about? Cheryl was just brilliant. She opened her mouth and was brilliant. She didn't have to do anything. Forget acting classes. She just was an incredible actor the minute she started, and a very lovable character on stage. It was a very hard character for me to play. I've suffered a lot, 6 months trying to get that character.
Mm-hmm.
It looks pretty easy, but it's a very, very, very difficult. Very different
mm-hmm.
conversation.